what we call was contour tracking and system ID on contour sequences. So the goal here is for deformable contour tracking, essentially sequential segmentation, to explain it very simply, of deforming objects or regions of interest from video or from spatial image sequences. You may want to do this offline in case you have volume images, for example, different images of the brain slice or different images of any other organs, different slices of an organ. You can do that offline, and it's called a smoothing problem. If you want to do it offline, which is term tracking usually comes from video processing or real-time applications where you want to track a moving object through a video sequence, that's where the term tracking actually comes from. So in this talk, I'll talk about the tracking algorithms, but the point is that most smoothing algorithms use the output of a tracker as an input. So if you can do tracking well, you can only improve your estimates, your boundary contour estimates, using a smoothing method. In the second part of the talk, I'll briefly touch upon very recent work that we've started on system identification, where given a sequence of contours, you estimate contour deformations from it, and then you want to estimate the effective dimension of deformation, and now, of course, what do you mean by effective dimension? I'll talk about that later. And then you want to define a temporal dynamics or sequence dynamics in general, which is the system ID problem, which I'll briefly touch upon in the end. So in this audience, I don't need to explain where deforming contours occur. All biological images have deformable objects, or deformable regions of interest, I should say. Object is an incorrect term. For example, the first sequence I show is a spatial sequence of brain image slices where the goal is to segment out the tumor in this particular case. Other reasons why deforming contours occur is because of sometimes rigid objects, which are partially occluded by another object, may result, for example, here you have a car that's passing under a street light. A third reason for deformations is perspective effects. You may have rigid objects being viewed by a camera with frequently changing viewpoints, which is what we show here, which is a plane being tracked by another UAV, and the plane flying through clouds. It's a very low contrast imagery. So it's a difficult sequential segmentation problem. So the outline of the talk is as follows. I'll explain what tracking really means in the context as we use it, discuss the main issues. The technique that we use to solve the tracking problem here is particle filtering. It's a Monte Carlo technique, which I'll briefly go over. We'll discuss existing work in this area and the key ideas. And I'll go on to the details. I'll present the two algorithms that we have proposed. Then I'll discuss how the same things can be extended to smoothing. Then if time permits, I'll talk about system ID. So now the tracking problem is essentially, simply said, you want to causally segment a moving and or deforming object from a sequence of images. That's tracking. When I say tracking, you want to do it causally, tracking again comes from when you have a video sequence. I'll keep using time, but time can always be replaced by a spatial sequence if needed. So you want to formulate this as a tracking problem. You want to estimate the state at time t, given observations until t, using all the observations until t. States in our case is the contour and the contour velocity, which are assumed to follow a Markov model. The state transition prior, which is assumed known. The observation, which is either the image or the edge map, which is basically the edge locations in the image, at time t depend only on the state at time t. These are two assumptions. This is what is called the hidden Markov model, commonly used in a whole lot of different applications. And again, you assume the observation likelihood, which is the likelihood of the image being generated by the contour, is assumed not. So for observation likelihood, we just borrow from segmentation literature. So that's not our contribution. Observation likelihood can be the likelihood of the image being generated by a contour, which could be a negative exponential of any segmentation energy functional. You could use channel Vesey, you could use edge energies, you could use sums of both, you could choose whichever is the best observation model for the particular type of sequences that you're segmenting. What our contribution is, how to use the system model, how to use the prior information about the sequence dynamics to improve your segmentation, to do segmentation sequentially instead of doing it one at a time for each sequence. So what we assume is the current contour is the previous contour plus a statistical model on the contour velocity. And that's the rough idea of problem framework. Oops. So this is the same thing expressed diagrammatically. You assume your object contour and velocities follow a Markov model. System noise just models uncertainty in your model, in your modeling. Pass through some nonlinear function which generates the scene, which is imaged by the camera, generates the observation. Now you want to use this observation, which is the image, or you may want to generate use only the edges from the image. Question.
Is it realistic to have a Markov model? Because maybe if something was moving really slowly for a long time, you would expect it to keep moving slowly for a long time, or if something like this. Is it realistic to ignore the past history of the object?
Well, so Markov model doesn't quite ignore the past history. So the current state depends on the previous state, but the previous state could depend on the state before the previous state, right? So if it's moving slowly, it will keep moving. Like, you're right. So that's modeling contour velocity still. So. So the correlation is actually infinite. It just slowly falls down. That's the only idea of the Markov model. So essentially, the goal is you have this image, and then you want to pass it through a filter, which in our case will be a particle filter. In simpler cases, in earlier work, people have used Kalman filtering, which a lot of you might be familiar with, where again, you do the same thing. You take the image, pass it through a filter, estimate the boundary contour. That's the goal. Couple of terms that I'll keep using over and over, so I thought let me define them. State transition prior, or state transition PDF, as people use it, which is the likelihood of the current state. The state here is the contour and the contour velocity, taking a certain value given the condition on the value of the previous state. Observation likelihood, again, probability of yt, which is the image in this case, taking a certain value condition on xt. Now, in a lot of contour tracking problems, in a lot of actually image tracking problems in general, we say people keep using the term the observation likelihood is multimodal. Now, what does that mean? That essentially means that your observation likelihood has multiple local maxima as a function of the state, where state of the contours. Or simply said, your image has multiple contour modes. So, examples. Okay, for example, in this sequence, you could have this. The left part of the car could be one contour mode, whereas the full car could be another contour mode, and so on and so forth. In low contrast imagery like this one, you could have the cyan, the dotted line could be one possible boundary, and the cyan solid line could be another possible boundary. So that's just an example of how the multiple modes occur. And I'll show more examples as we go along. So, in this work, we concentrate on two major problems which haven't been completely addressed in past work. One is, like I said earlier, the observation likelihood is often multimodal. Reasons for multimodality are overlapping cluttering objects in the background, partial occlusions in the foreground, or low contrast imagery. Now, even when you have, so obviously there have been multiple modes in the images forever, but if you had a high enough frame rate, so if your state transition prior was narrow, your posterior would be unimodal. Essentially what I'm saying is, simply said, so here I plot the two modes, the negative logarithm of the observation likelihood, which is the black line here. Now, it's bimodal here. Now, if your state prior were narrow, then your posterior, which is the sum of these two, will have a single mode right here. Whereas if your prior is broad, so if it's a fast deforming sequence, this is in 1D, your deformations are in very high dimensional space, of course. So if you're, so that's the basic intuition. So this one slide essentially explains the main idea. If your prior is broad, then your posterior, which is the red star, will have multiple modes, will also have two modes. Taking this to the extreme, if your prior was completely flat, your posterior would look exactly like the likelihood. So the same thing can be extended to multiple dimensions, the same essential intuition. So that's a problem. So if your state transition prior is broad, in effect what I'm saying is your sequence is deforming much faster compared to the frame rate. Now if your sequence is deforming fast and you also could get images at a very fast frame rate, you would be fine. But if not, then your state transition prior or STP is broad, and in that case you cannot adapt linear techniques such as Kalman filtering. When your posterior was unimodal, what people did was, in early work on contour tracking, Blake, Isard, Reynard, all the way going back to 1994, was that he looked at the predicted state, which is this value right here, searched for the observation likelihood mode that was closest to the predicted state. So they found a predicted contour, they searched for edges in the vicinity of this predicted contour, and they used that as the new observation, and went ahead with that and kept doing that. Now that can be possible if you have this kind of situation, but if you have this kind of situation, you're not sure which of the two is the right mode to deal with. And oftentimes you need to keep both modes because your future estimates of your state may depend on both of these modes, not just one mode.
Excuse me, is this supposed to be used real-time or a posteriori analysis of interactive data.
Well, real time. So tracking, by definition, is real time. You could do a posteriori analysis, which is a smoothing problem where you want to use future observations also to analyze the past. But even to do that, at least the algorithms I know of do one forward pass, so go through the sequence in the forward direction and then run a backward pass.
Is your goal to try to match sampling rate so that you will be able to stick to your model, or are you assuming the sampling rate somebody else decides?
No. I'm assuming I'm given a sampling rate, and what can I do with it? So if my sampling rate is too slow, then I am in this kind of a situation, and then I have to use a different technique for tracking. Multimodal observation likelihoods, like I said earlier, if you have background clutter due to separate objects, for example here, or you have overlapping clutter, that's another reason. So in this case, you have multiple modes of contour deformation. In this case, you have overlapping background. So the light gray object is clutter, whereas you want to track the dark gray object. You have deforming contours and low contrast. Low contrast also results in multiple modes, like I said earlier. Here is another example. Partial occlusions is the third reason for multiple modes. Partial occlusions also. You may want to track the full car, or you may want to track the car only to the left of the street light. So those are good examples. Yeah, so now the two issues that we address is your likelihoods can be multimodal for all the reasons I just explained. And the second is that your contours are deforming. So in theory, when you say deforming contours, each contour point can move independently, which is what makes the state space dimension quite large. If you had constrained motion example, just rigid or affine motion, on a small dimensional space, it's easy to use particle filtering techniques. I will explain what a particle filter is and why it gets difficult as dimension increases. Now, if your state space dimension is large, particle filtering is expensive. What that means is it requires an impractically large number of particles or large number of Monte Carlo samples to perform a given tracking algorithm. Examples of multimodal oil, I talked about this, low contrast. Deforming contours applications, I briefly mentioned this, you have actual deformations which result in deforming contours, which are applications, human tracking, surveillance, sports videos, which is what actually my earlier background was earlier. I did a lot of, during my PhD I worked a lot on surveillance applications, which is where I got into video analysis as such. You may want to track animals, just the fish or other examples. Or you may have medical sequences, or in general you may have biological sequences. You may have cell tracking is another new problem I learned about recently, where cell shapes change over time. Or there are other reasons for deforming contours. It could be changing regions of partial occlusions, or changing camera viewpoints. Some example images. So large dimensional state spaces, since I added this slide because other than contour tracking, which is what I'm talking about today, large dimensional state spaces occur in a huge, in a large number of other problems, some of which people talked about in the morning today. So you may want to track spatially varying physical quantities, such as temperature or pressure or other environmental sensing parameters, which we discussed in the morning, where using a large network of sensors spread out all across the place. There, So if the temperature spatial variation is large, you need to track temperature fairly closely. Again, you use Nyquist criterion to decide how closely you want to sample temperature. You may want to track boundaries of a chemical spill or target emissions over time. That might be another large dimensional problem. You may have time-varying system transfer functions that you may want to estimate or track over time. There are other applications where the same kind of techniques that I'll talk about in the next couple of slides would be applicable. Multimodality occurs, for example, when you're using networks of sensors. If one sensor fails, then that is one other cause of multimodality, because sensor failure could be thought of as what we think of as clutter in image processing. So sensor fails, it outputs a random number which is not related to your actual temperature, and that creates a false mode that you want to get rid of. With that introduction, let me explain briefly, give an overview of what particle filtering is. Sequential Monte Carlo technique to approximate the Bayes recursion for computing the posterior. What it does is it essentially uses a sequential version of important sampling along with a resampling step, which I will briefly explain for those that are not familiar with it. So the goal of basic Monte Carlo, of any Monte Carlo integration technique, is if you want to compute the expected value of any function of a random variable x, and x is distributed according to some p, if you cannot perform this integration analytically, you need to do this numerically, which is why you use Monte Carlo. Simple Monte Carlo says that if you want to perform this integration and you can't do it, generate samples, Monte Carlo samples, from p, from the probability density function p, and compute the numerical average of gamma of xi, gamma computing function of x. Now, this is possible to do only if you can compute p and efficiently sample from it. In a lot of situations, one of which is posterior computation, you cannot compute p at all. Or in other situations, you may be able to compute p, but you cannot sample from it. In which case, what you can do is, you can choose your favorite importance density q, and just multiply this, look at this integration, and multiply and divide by q, so you get this form. So there, what you could do is, you could sample particles or sample sample from q and compute a weighted average of gamma xi, where the weights are now proportional to p upon q. And that's the essential idea of importance sampling. The idea is that you want, of course, to make this efficient, your q should be as close to p as possible. The best q that you can choose is p itself. But if you can't, sometimes you don't know p, but you know the mode of p. In that cases, for example, in a lot of existing work, people have tried to use Gaussian approximations to p about its mode as an important sampling density. What particle filter? So the design part in important sampling is how to choose q in a smart way, which is what we will also concentrate on in effect. But for the specific situation of sequential important sampling, without giving much more details, the essential idea of important sampling, sequential important sampling, is at time t for each particle I, so I will go from 1 to n, n could be 50 or 100 or 2000 depending on the type of problem and depending on the type of accuracy you need. At each time instant, I'm using t, but it could be space instead of time, you sample the ith particle from an importance density that depends on the previous particle and on the current observation. And since you are trying to approximate the posterior, which, remember, the posterior, so your weights will be proportional to the previous weights times the posterior divided by q. But guess what? The posterior is proportional to the likelihood, which is this term, times the prior, straight transition prior. So essentially, your weights are proportional to the likelihood times the prior divided by the importance density, all of them computed at the current particle value. So this is the idea of sequential importance sampling. Particle filtering has an extra step, which is called the resampling step, which is a standard step, which we just use a standard algorithm, I won't talk about it here, but that completes the loop, and then you go on to the next time instant. So with that brief introduction, we describe the main ideas of our work. First, let me give you briefly. There's been a huge amount of work on contour tracking starting all the way in the early 90s. The initial work used a Kalman filter, or a linear observer, basically. It used a finite dimensional contour representation. Your contour was, for example, you could just choose n points around the contour boundary. And since the essential idea was the same, you predict the contour using a system model. Again, you have a system model which you know or you learn from, which is the system ID problem. You predict the next contour at the next time step, search in its vicinity. So for example, Blake, Isard, Reinhardt, what they did was they predicted a new contour, searched along the normal to the contour points, and searched along the normal to the contour at the contour points for the closest edge. Wherever they found the closest edge was the new contour point. That was the new observed contour, and they went ahead with that. The implicit assumption in doing that is that your posterior is unimodal, and you're only picking the right likelihood mode. The first work that used particle filtering in computer vision was the condensation, and after that, I've cited that, but there's been a huge amount of work using particle filtering for this problem since then. But most of it has the same problem. It's able to handle multimodal posteriors. It's able to handle model clutter and occlusion, which is the best great part about the condensation paper. But it tracks only on a small dimensional space. It's able to track only on the six-dimensional space of affine deformations. Later work did other things, but again, the main bottleneck is all algorithms that I know of are tracking only on a small dimensional space. In recent literature, people have used a level set representation of the contour, which, of course, we have Stanov here sitting right here, so but I probably didn't cite. So for me, I'm using level set method just as a technique, so I didn't put, there's a huge amount of work. Level set method started, I think, back in 1988, Osher Sethian, and again, huge amount of work after that. So the essential idea is to represent the contour as the zero level set of a two-dimensional function. And okay, anyway, for the purpose of this talk, instead of the level set method, you could use any other method of contour representation as long as you're able to deal with contour length changes. Recent work by Jackson Yezi Soato and Ithamar Tannenbaum and a couple of other people, what they did was they defined approximate linear observers along with the level set representation of the contour. Bottleneck still was that posterior is unimodal. Only so many cases can be dealt with. So just to give you an example of the type of sequences where condensation doesn't work, just a simple video. This is condensation of 30 particles, completely loses track of the plane because there is some non-affinity, because this plane is being viewed by another UAV, another unmanned air vehicle which is moving, so there's frequent viewpoint changes. Even with 1200 particles, it's able to keep track of the rough location, but it's not quite able to track the boundary, the actual boundary of the plane. Possible solution is to represent the contour using the level set method representation, but to replace the approximate linear observer by a particle filter. In theory, this would solve all problems, but in practice, brute force particle filtering can get very expensive in this case. But note that this and the next few slides give two key ideas. But so even though when I'm saying the space of contour deformations is large dimensional, essentially what's happening is at any given time, most deformation is occurring in a small number of dimensions, which we call the effective basis. While the deformation in the rest of the dimensions is small. Now, of course, this effective basis could also change with time, and there are questions of how to detect that change and estimate the new basis. I would like to point out, though, and a lot of one reviewer had this question, so after that I decided to point it out every time, is that this is related to but different from dimension reduction assumption, where so if you have a stationary time series and you have this kind of a situation, you could get rid of your directions where the deformation is small or where any state change is small. But if you have non-stationarity, if your contour sequences are non-stationary, so essentially what I'm saying is if small amounts of deformation, if they were thrown away over time, they could result in a large error, basically. So you can't get rid of those dimensions. What you can do is you can do regular particle filtering on these small dimensions. And you could do something approximate in this residual space, which is the essential idea of what we do. Now, the second key fact is that if your residual deformation is small enough, compared to the distance between the likelihood modes, compared to the distance between the contour modes in the image, it's easy to show. I showed the example for 1D, the same basic idea extends to multiple dimensions, that the residual posterior, which is the posterior of residual deformation conditioned on the effective basis states, is unimodal. And the way you ensure this is by choosing enough number of dimensions as part of the effective basis. Once you can show that this residual posterior is unimodal, a very efficient way of important sampling is to find the mode of this residual posterior and define a Gaussian density around it and sample from it. An even better idea is if your residual, which is what happens in a lot of contour tracking problems, is if your residual posterior is not just unimodal, but it's also fairly narrow, you could in effect approximate it by a Dirac delta function at its mode, which is what I'm saying here. So if you're sampling from a density that's very narrow, any sample from it will be close to its mode. So why not just use the mode as a sample? So why do random important sampling? Why do random sampling at all? This is what we call the mode tracking approximation of important sampling, which is what we do on the residual space. And the resulting algorithm we call particle filtering with a mode tracker. So the essential idea is that you're if you had 100 dimensional space on 6 or 8 or 10 dimensions, you're actually doing important sampling. On the rest of the dimensions, you're just tracking the mode. Of course, that's introducing more error, but what that's helping you is your sampling dimension is reduced from 100 to 6 now. So the number of particles required for effective tracking is much smaller now. So when you're when your n available is small, which is true for large dimensional problems, you're actually, the net resulting error is small. This is, of course, something we observe experimentally. We don't have analysis of it yet. So based on these three key ideas, we have two algorithms. The first one we call affine PFMT, where the idea is that you treat the space of affine deformations, which is a six-dimensional space in for 2D problems, as your effective basis. So said simply, just performing burden sampling to track on the six-dimensional space of affine deformations, exactly as you would in the condensation algorithm, except that your contour representation is different, but that's besides the point. And that will become important later when I talk about the second algorithm. For each affine deformed contour particles, just estimate the unique mode of the posterior of non-affine deformation. This turns out to be, estimating the unique mode turns out to be a minimization problem, and we all know, yeah.
How do you know that with affine you're going to get a unique mode?
Sorry?
You say that you can guarantee that the residue would be unimodal if you put enough dimensions, but
mm-hmm.
how do you know that with affine as your basis?
You're assuming that your residue will be unimodal. Yeah, okay, I should have mentioned that earlier,
you,
I probably have it later.
Have you experimentally, because you can compute your residue and see if it's truly unimodal. You could compute it. A posteriori, I mean, you could just do an experiment of tracking and segmenting by hand, assuming an affine motion, and verify if your residue is unimodal. Have you done that?
We have not verified that, no, we haven't. What we get from the derivation that we had was that you can assume your affine deformation is, your posterior of non-affine deformation is unimodal. You can assume that if, either the small non-affine deformation per frame, so the airplane sequences that I showed you, or if the likelihood modes, if the contour modes in the image are separated only by translation or scale or such. So those are the kind of sequences where this kind of an algorithm works. For other more general sequences, this is the second algorithm which I've talked about. No, but now the question is, I'll talk to you about this offline, but yeah, we haven't. So yeah, the assumption here I should have mentioned is that the posterior of non-affine deformation is unimodal. It's efficient because you're sampling on six-dimensional space. This appeared. This is joint work with Yogesh Rathi, Tannenbaum, and Tony Yezzi at Georgia Tech. Now, this is the algorithm in detail, which I will skip in the interest of time. So this comes to Guillermo's question of what are you assuming? You're assuming here that posterior or non-affine deformation is unimodal. Well, yes, you could actually experimentally verify it. So what you're assuming, the reason you can't experimentally verify it so easily is you're assuming that the posterior, so condition on the affine deformation particle is unimodal, so which is something that changes on the fly. So it's difficult, it's not so easy to verify. So that's actually the ongoing part of the work, is how to verify these conditions on the fly in an efficient manner. You can verify them if you had infinite time, but in practice you can't. In practice, you only gain some intuition from the derivation that you can use to design better algorithms. So like I said, the intuition gained is, which is, this is discussed in more detail in our ICAST paper, that this assumption is satisfied either when there is small non-affine deformation per frame, or essentially it's a slowly deforming sequence. Most of the deformation, most of the motion is because of affine deformation. Or your observation likelihood mode, which is basically the contour modes in the image are only separated by either translation or scale or other affine deformation. Examples where this holds is images with non-overlapping clutter. If you have multiple moving objects separated and a clear non-high contrast image, or images with cluttering objects where the background cluttering object is separated from the foreground object by scale, for example. A bigger circle inside behind a smaller one, maybe. Or if you have overlapping clutter, or you have one of these reasons, but you have small non-affine deformation per frame. Typical examples are any low-resolution video. You have a human body contour viewed from a distance, there's only small deformations. Or you have a rigid body viewed at a camera viewpoint changes. Some examples, didn't show this video. This is human body contour viewed from a distance. Low contrast with viewpoint changes. assumption fails, like they pointed out, when there is large non-affine deformation per frame. Essentially, it's a fast deforming sequence compared to the frame rate that you have. And your likelihood is multimodal as a function of non-affine deformation. So low contrast imagery, overlapping clutter, partial occlusions. All of these result in multimodal residual posteriors of non-affine deformation. One example, again, this is a simulated example where we show that affine PFMT fails, is when you have small, so we simulated a sequence with small non-affine deformation where the algorithm works. If you have much larger non-affine deformation, like in this sequence, this is two frames apart, this is frame 2, 4, 6, 8, the algorithm fails, which is, and this motivates the second algorithm that I'll talk about now, which of course works here, that's why I have shown it. So the main intuition here is that for multimodal, you need an important sampling step that also samples on the space of local deformations. So here what we do is, again, use the same PFMT idea, which was first proposed in the CVPR 2005 paper, but use deformation at a subsampled set of k contour points, which we call the basis points, as effective basis. K, which is the number of basis points, can be fixed or time varying. So remember, here we are subsampling deformation. The contour representation still remains the same. So there are, of course, a lot of open questions here. Let me first give you the overview of the algorithm, and I'll discuss the multiple issues that we actually face and we try to solve. The idea is that for each time instant, each particle, you'll do these three steps. You'll important sample, you'll first important sample translation and move the contour, nice and simple. Then you'll important sample deformation at k subsampled basis points, and on these k subsampled basis points, you can define a simple Gauss-Markov model of how your contour shape changes. Now, so after these two steps, you have a sample of deformation at this k. Let's say k is 6, so you have deformation at these k uniformly spaced points along the contour. Now you want to interpolate it to get deformation at all contour points. We just chose to use B-spline basis for interpolation. There is no pressing reason to use that. One could use cubic interpolation or any other nice interpolation that you like. Then, of course, you have to go through the usual steps of implementing the level set method. You want to obtain the extension velocity and use it to move the level set function. This is where we run into problems, and this is where all the experts in this room can help me, actually. So now, the difference is, we are not using level set representation to perform gradient descent, but we are using it to do important sampling. So essentially, the deformation velocity that we get is now a roughly linear function of a six-dimensional or an eight-dimensional Gaussian random variable. So essentially, the maximum value of the deformation could be, in theory, it could be infinity. In practice, it's at least 3 or 5 sigma. So now, to implement this one iteration of motion of one particle, you may sometimes have to need. The way we implement this to satisfy CFL is to run multiple iterations of the level set method to move this contour by that amount. So to give an example, if your maximum deformation velocity is 5, then you will have to run at least 5 iterations to implement one motion for one particle. Then this is followed by the mode tracking step, which is, as before, you want to compute the unique mode of residual deformation of the posterior, which is, again, assumed a unimodal in this case. There is, again, no clear-cut way of checking whether this is true or not. Then you set this contour particle input to the mode. This step is nice and simple because it's a minimization problem. We know how to do minimization using level set representation. One approximation that we use to speed the second step up is we say that the unique mode of the posterior can be approximately computed by running only a few gradient descent iterations to minimize only the likelihood, not adding the prior, that's the point. And then you wait and resample and then go back to the next time step. Implementation issues, as I mentioned, this makes the algorithm really slow in its current form. Of course, I also implemented it in MATLAB, which is the other bottleneck. Interpolation and computing extension velocities efficiently, there's no clear-cut answers. The way we are doing it is fairly slow. Now, the other question is, I know we have the CFL condition for deterministic PDEs, but now what we're evolving is not a PDE to convergence, but it's probably a stochastic PDE that you're trying to solve. So now, is there a different CFL condition for this type of a problem, or what is the correct way to do it? We have one implementation where we are using multiple iterations in order to satisfy CFL, which is of course making the method really slow. The second question, which I didn't quite mention till now, is what is the best way to parameterize contour deformation? These are the two ways that I've implemented, the ones that I've mentioned here. You could think of deformation as a function of contour arc length, which is one way to think of it. Or you may want to think of deformation as a function of the radial angle. Or you may want to think of deformation as a one-dimensional function of tangent angle. So both types of representations have their problems. And of course, it's not clear. I've talked to a couple of people, and there's no clear answer on which is the correct way to parameterize deformation. And of course, the third question is how to estimate and change the effective basis dimension. So again, no clear-cut answers, but the technique we are approaching is to use spatial frequency response of to think of deformation as a spatial periodic signal and estimate its approximate bandwidth, R percent bandwidth, and go from there. That's roughly the idea. Okay. How much time do I have?
4 minutes.
So this is the same thing repeated. What you're assuming in deformed PFMT is that your residual deformation variance is small compared to the distance between the likelihood modes. And to satisfy this assumption, you may need to change k over time. K is the number of basis points to satisfy these assumptions. Again, there's no clear-cut answer on how small is small. How small is small to justify ISMT? For the first part, we have a theoretical answer, but in implementation, it's very difficult to deal with. The second part, we don't even have a theoretical answer on how small is small to justify replacing imported sampling by mode tracking. So those are all open questions. Fairly recent work. Example applications where the thing does work is segmenting. So this is again, it's actually an offline problem. It's a sequence of brain MRI slices. But we treat it as an online problem and perform tracking. We could as well apply a smoothing algorithm, particle filter smoothing algorithm on it, which could only improve the results because you're using the future observations also for segmentation. Simulated sequence where we simulated outlier. Imagery, we generally added very high variance random noise to every even frame, and then tried to track it. This algorithm works, the previous one doesn't, obviously, because your modes are now most definitely separated by non-affine deformation. Relation to, of course, the proposed algorithm has a lot of relation to a lot of existing work, recent work actually. The particle filtering method itself can be understood as an extension of Doucet's method. Doucet is a faculty member at UBC now. It can also be understood as an approximation to Raoult black polarization, which is another particle filtering technique for models that are conditionally linear Gaussian. Then there's recent work by Alan Wilsky's group in Mikai 2004, where he where San et al. They use a particle filter for tracking the heart left ventricle. Their idea may be understood, it actually appeared around the same time as our work. Maybe it's Mikai 2005, I'm not sure. They use PFMT, could be interpreted as PFMT with a PCA effective basis, with retaining only the MAP particle at each time instant. Of course, existing work, for example, Jackson Yezzi Swartow's work may be interpreted as PFMT with a zero dimensional effective basis. So you're not doing important sampling there at all. Condensation could be interpreted as the same thing with a zero-dimensional residual space. So you're not doing mode tracking there at all. So that what our work is somewhere in between these two methods, basically. The idea of subsampling deformation is motivated by a recent work on stochastic active contours. I think VLSM 2004 is the reference for this. Kerry Venn et al. Are the authors. Where they used a similar idea, they basically added noise, chose a bunch of points, bunch of four points around, uniformly spaced around a contour, and added noise there. And the idea there was to avoid local minimas in segmentation. Each time instant, they added some noise, spatially smoothed the noise, which is equivalent to interpolating the noise, to get a deformation velocity. And then they did use that for performing difficult segmentation problems. So smoother, the same things could be done offline. This is just something I added. Brief overview. I'll just probably explain the problem, the main idea, and I'll skip the rest, go over to the open issues. The system identification problem as we formulated is, you have a sequence of contour deformations which can be thought of as a time sequence of periodic spatial signals which are heavily oversampled. And given this deformation sequence, you want to estimate its effective dimension and you want to learn the temporal dynamics. So those are the two problems. To estimate the effective dimensions, as I said, you could use the spatial frequency response or the power spectral density if you're treating deformation as a random process. You could compute the effective bandwidth for an assay, just again for a simulated sequence. Let me show it for one sequence. If you have two contours, the blue and the dotted blue, you estimate the deformation, which is estimate the normal. Okay, so whenever I talk of deformation, I'm talking about deformation only along the normal direction. Plot it as a one-dimensional function of arc length. Compute, do this for a set, for a sequence of deformations, which are assumed to be temporally stationary. Compute the power spectral density, which is the expected value of the squared Fourier transform magnitude. Compute, so if assume a certain, so now this 0.05% is just, there's no correct way of how much residual deformation to model. So if you wanted to allow for 0.05% residual deformation, you can see that the k that you eventually get applying the Nyquist criterion is 12 in this particular case. If you were happy with 5% residual deformation, you get a k of 6 and so on and so forth. So this is really work in progress. Just the basic simulation ideas in place, temporal dynamics. Applications, I'll take a minute to finish. Applications, of course, are in estimating the dimension for tracking, but applications can also be in direct recognition problems by model comparison, detecting changes in a sequence by detecting changes in K or in the entire PSD. Again, applications, potential applications could be in brain shape changes during surgery, what is normal, what is not. In disease progression models like schizophrenia or other types of diseases,